The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Trade war, it's everywhere in the news right now. And if you listen to the media, the US is, or the world is on the brink of a trade war. And it is all US President Donald Trump's fault.
Wall Street is worried about a trade war. President Trump says he will slap tariffs on steel and aluminum.
The president's hasty announcement of a trade war appears to have been spooking markets, and now this morning he is doubling down in a tweet. He wrote, when a country, USA, is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win.
But many in his own party are sharply criticizing the president's decision, concerned about a potential trade war that damages the U.S. economy.
Do you think that this risks starting a trade war that goes beyond this?
I mean, it could.
Here we are seemingly stumbling to a trade war with our allies in Europe.
So Donald Trump has just started a trade war. That's the general consensus. But is that the full picture? Well, let's take a deeper look at trade wars today, because there's something critical to understand here, something that's dramatically unreported in the news. We'll go into a bit of economics today because there is a vital story here. But it's a story that has, and it's a story that has huge implications for Britain, for the future of the US. It's a story that leaps right off the pages of your Bible. Now, generally, the way this looming trade war is being reported is it's in a pretty narrow way, with no reference to the context or history, even recent history, of what is happening here. But to start with, here are some clips from March 8 from President Trump announcing that he would put tariffs on steel and aluminium, which is what many are saying could trigger the start of a trade war.
Thank you very much, everybody. This is not merely an economic disaster, but it's a security disaster. We want to build our ships. We want to build our planes. We want to build our military equipment with steel, with aluminum from our country. And now we're finally taking action to correct this long overdue problem. Today, I'm defending America's national security by placing tariffs on foreign imports of steel and aluminum. We will have a 25% tariff on foreign steel and a 10% tariff on foreign aluminum when the product comes across our borders. It's a process called dumping.
So there's Donald Trump announcing this new tariff on steel and aluminium. And of course, while the rest of the world is not at all happy about that. Here's a news clip on how the European Union is responding, focusing on a speech from European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker.
Two can play at that game, the warning from the EU pledging retaliatory strikes if President Trump goes ahead with plans to impose import tariffs on steel and aluminium. The countermeasures envisaged by the European Commission president have iconic American companies in their sights. So now we will also impose import tariffs, he said in Hamburg. This is basically a stupid process, the fact that we have to do this, but we have to do it. We'll now impose tariffs on motorcycles, Harley Davidson, on blue jeans, Levi's, on bourbon. We can also do stupid. We also have to be this stupid.
So I think you see what he thinks of this whole situation. Yeah, pretty cross. But we've got another, we'll play another quick clip as well. This is from the European Trade Commissioner, and she's outlining the responses that the European Commission is getting ready now to put in place to try and strike back at the United States.
It's been taken by the European Union. But we have made clear that if a move like this is taken, it will hurt the European Union. It will put thousands of European jobs in jeopardy, and it has to be met by a firm and proportionate response. in disguise, not a national security measure. That means that the EU is entitled to make use of the WTO safeguard agreement to rebalance benefits that we have given to the US in the past. This would be done by carrying out measures that match the economic loss suffered by us because of the US move. In certain cases, provided very specific criteria are met, this rebalance is allowed to take place immediately. So we are discussing different US products from which import tariffs can be imposed. And this provisional list has been discussed for college this morning.
So she's saying that they can, in certain situations, put tariffs on immediately. They're promising a strong response. China has also responded firmly. They promised firm and strong measures to defend our interests. Unfortunately, they promised that in Chinese, so there's not much point me playing that clip for you. So China and the EU, they're all painting the picture that Donald Trump is single-handedly starting this trade war and that they're reluctantly now forced to strike back to defend themselves. This is also the picture that we heard from that montage at the top that the media is generally placing, that, again, Donald Trump is starting a trade war, that Europe, that China are going to be forced soon to defend themselves. But that's not what's going on here. Not if you look at something that includes just any sense of recent history. We'll listen to just one more clip from Donald Trump as he made this announcement of these trade tariffs.
The American steel aluminum industry has been ravaged by aggressive foreign trade practices. It's really an assault on our country. It's been an assault. They know better than anybody.
And he's exactly right. It has been an assault on America for decades, coming from China and coming from Germany. Donald Trump is only starting a trade war in the sense that he's fighting back. Thus far, really, America's just been the victim of a trade beatdown, where other powers have attacked, and to use the kind of trade war metaphor, America, and America's done very, very little to defend itself. Why hasn't it defended itself? Well, Germany and China, they've been fighting this trade war in a similar way that Russia fought its war in Ukraine. They avoid actions that seem like an outright declaration of war. In Ukraine, Russia sent in soldiers without any uniforms on, used unmarked helicopters, etc., to kind of muddy the waters. And in that way, they were able to go in there, and other nations, while they knew that Russia was behind it, but because it was kind of outside of the normal parameters in which war was fought, they didn't know how to respond and ended up doing nothing. That's exactly the way Germany and China have been waging a trade war on the United States. Just different enough from the standard tight way a trade war would be fought, avoiding things that might seem like an outright declaration of trade war. And America has known what's going on, but because of this has been divided on how to respond and has ended up not really doing anything. So let's look at some of the specifics. Let's look at just the scale of the trade war that has been waged historically on the United States by these powers. Now, the first thing that we'll look at, and we'll look first at China, because the European Union, well, it's Germany in particular, has been they've been very subtle and very clever in how they've waged this trade war on the United States. China has been a bit more outright and a bit more obvious about it. So we'll start with them. And the first thing we'll look at is subsidies. Subsidies have they're one of the standard weapons in a trade war. So what Donald Trump is doing, he's putting in place tariffs where this makes goods coming from other countries more expensive. So instead of, I don't know, $100 for that sheet of steel, it becomes, was it a 25? I can't remember exactly how much, but say it becomes $110. There's a tax on there, $10 goes to the US government, and it's now more expensive to buy steel coming from other countries, so consumers would be more likely to buy steel that's made in the United States. So tariffs are fairly standard. Subsidies are kind of the reverse. A government may want to make its manufacturers in its home country be able to do better selling abroad. And so they hand these manufacturers some money to help them bring prices down. So a gadget might normally cost $100. the government could subsidize them and say, okay, well, for each gadget that you sell, we'll pay you $20. And then that way you can sell your gadgets for $80 and still make a profit. And so a government might do this, and then that way it can encourage its gadget manufacturers to do well. They'll undercut competition abroad. They'll be able to get more business. More jobs would be created. I'm not arguing that subsidies are a good thing, but that they are a standard weapon in economic warfare, and that's how they work. It helps manufacturers in that government's country, and it makes it harder for foreign manufacturers to compete. And so because of this, subsidies, well, they're considered a weapon of economic war. They're, World Trade Organization agreements, the GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, frown upon large subsidies and generally outlaw or impose fines on large subsidies. But China has managed to skirt around this for years. And in a large part, it's because in China, the line between big business and government is blurred. And so it makes it very easy for the government to just quietly hand out subsidies in a much less overt, much less outright way that's very hard to detect and stop. And it's had a huge impact on global trade. It's just not been quite overt enough to trigger much of a US response. Sometimes America will take China to the World Trade Organization over some fairly narrow and specific subsidies, and they've won a few cases at the WTO doing that. But the relationship between the Chinese government and business is so close and so murky that most of the subsidies are just hidden. You can't see them. They don't show up. They're not an obvious outright subsidy. And so it's very hard for the United States to address that. The London School of Economics, in its Centrepiece magazine in 2013, they estimated that China was spending up to 1.5% of its GDP on subsidies for foreign-owned export-focusing businesses. So 1.5% of its entire economy spent on this. This is just one area of subsidies. So what they would do here, this was in place until 2008, foreign-owned firms that exported at least 70% of all that they made exported from China, well, they only had to pay half the standard corporation tax. So basically, this encouraged foreign companies to do their manufacturing in China. If you're a foreign company and you set up your manufacturing hub in China and you use that to export around the world, well, then you would get very generous tax breaks from the Chinese government. Then you had, China's covered in special economic zones that offer further lower tax rates. And then because the government is so integrated with the business world, they could offer favored companies things like cheap loans, cheap utilities, free land to build their factories on. So they're offering this, and it's no coincidence that during that time, a huge number of manufacturers moved their factories to China. The government was really encouraging them to do that, making it much cheaper for them to operate factories in China. So they'd move their factories to China and then produce these goods in China, sell them to the rest of the world. The London School of Economics wrote that the subsidies have been instrumental in contributing and concentrating a tremendous amount of manufacturing activity in China. And these subsidies also then discourage foreign firms from selling within China itself, because if they start selling too much within China, they lose out on these generous tax breaks that they were getting from the Chinese government. They only got those tax breaks if they were selling to export from China. So they would focus their manufacturing in China and use it to sell abroad. But China doesn't just subsidize foreign-owned firms. It subsidizes domestic firms as well. Usha C.V. Haley and George T. Haley, they had an article, well, they wrote a book about the same time, and they had an article about it in the Harvard Business Review in 2013. And they wrote that government subsidies to produce technologically advanced products and undercut foreign manufacturers have buttressed China's trade prowess. They talk about how that since 2000, the value of Chinese exports more than quadrupled, increased more than fourfold. They looked at several specific industries: solar, steel, gas, paper, auto parts. And they said that China had massive growth in these areas. And it wasn't because China had lower labor costs. It was because the Chinese government was subsidizing goods in these areas, helping China make products cheaper than European companies could or American companies could, because they were getting government money from the Chinese government to sell those goods cheaper. They wrote that we found that Chinese companies could only do this because of subsidies they received from China's central and provincial governments. These subsidies took the form of free or low-cost loans, artificially cheap raw materials, components, energy and land, and support for research and development and technological acquisitions. Now, around the same time, these two gave a presentation for the Center of for Strategic and International Studies. And here's how, here's what Usha Haley, here's a few clips from her presentation back in 2013.
We think that subsidies to Chinese industry are the game changer of this century and the most under-researched topic that we are confronting. In the last 5 years or so, we have seen China move from net importer to the largest manufacturer and largest exporter in capital-intensive industries in which it enjoyed no comparative advantage just a decade ago. In the last 5 years or so, we have seen industrialized countries become primarily exporters of scrap and commodities to China, and we have watched the effects on business strategy and national competitive advantage. We looked at subsidies that we could calculate and that we could obtain. And very frankly, that is the tip of the iceberg, because we couldn't get data for most of the subsidies that we knew existed. Now, there are many anecdotal stories about subsidies. We even found data for subsidies that we could not verify from other sources, and so we discarded it. Our data are literally, as I said, the tip of the iceberg. We looked at free or low-cost loans, subsidies to energy, including electricity, thermal and coking coal, and natural gas, and subsidies to inputs such as soda ash, pulp, recycled paper, glass, cold-rolled steel, as well as subsidies to land, where land was given for free, for example, and to technology, which is primarily the acquisition of technology or the development of technology. Our data, we'd be the first to say, has several problems. Among them, the institutional limitations of obtaining these kind of data in China.
So this is the game changer of the century. China has been this economic miracle with all of these factories relocating to China, but it's not because of any kind of fair competition. It's because the government has been cheating on trade. The game changer of the century. This, and it's had huge impacts in America, in job losses in manufacturing. And as you heard there, really, it's hard to get the full picture because the Chinese government, you know, they don't say, okay, yes, this is how many subsidies we're giving. It's all cloaked. It's all hidden because Chinese government has links to a whole load of these countries. So even they said, well, it's huge. But even this huge bit that we've been examining, it's just the tip of the iceberg. So, for example, when it comes to steel, like Donald Trump has been talking about, and he's putting these tariffs in place, well, that is how China has managed to do so well in steel. They went over elsewhere in that article some of the data and about how China kind of went from producing, I think it was just 5-6% of global steel to 50%. And its subsidies are the way that they do it. Steel requires a lot of, it's very energy intensive to produce. It needs a lot of heat. So the government was subsidizing the coal to the tune of billions of dollars. So Chinese companies are getting cheap coal off the government. They're getting free land to build their manufacturing plants to make steel. And so, of course, steel firms in America can't compete. They're not getting cheap coal from the government. Instead, they're getting the exact opposite. Environmental tariffs and things like that, making it more expensive. They're not getting free land from the government. So, of course, American steel manufacturers end up closing down while China ends up selling more and more. Just another quote from these two, Professor or Dr. Haley's from the Harvard Business Review. Since 2001, when China joined the World Trade Organization, subsidies have annually financed over 20% of the expansion of the country's manufacturing capacity. That huge Chinese subsidies have led to massive excess global capacity, increased exports, and depressed worldwide prices, and have hollowed out other countries' industrial bases. So this has had a huge effect on the United States. And this is just one area of trade war. Let's look at another one now that has played a major role in the rise of China's manufacturing capability. And that is intellectual property theft. Now, if you're a Chinese firm and you want to do business in the United States, it's pretty straightforward. You have to abide by the same rules that American companies have to abide by. You have to pay the same taxes that they have to pay. You have some import duties and things like that, but they're pretty trivial. But it's relatively straightforward for you to sell in the United States. The other way around is much, much harder. For certain industries like energy, communication, telecommunication, car manufacturing, if you're a foreign company, an American company, you cannot simply just go and sell your goods in China. You can't make cars in the United States, stick them on a boat and sell them in China. That's not allowed. Instead, you have to form a joint venture with a Chinese company. So in practice, this usually means working with a Chinese company until that company learns everything that they need to know about how you make your product, any trade secrets, copyrighted secrets, the technology that you're working on. And then with the help of the Chinese government, then they go solo and make that product for cheaper than you could because they're getting that help from the government. So that stops American companies doing business in China, and then it helps Chinese companies. In other industries, the government just simply won't allow foreign companies to do business until they've been able to look very closely over the technology that they'll be selling. Often things that it would be normally trade secrets. The Chinese government says, well, we have to see that. You have to show it to us. Otherwise, you can't do business in our country. And then they take that, and in very many cases, they give that to Chinese firms. The American Chamber of Commerce wrote last April, Chinese government authorities jeopardize the value of trade secrets by demanding unnecessary disclosure of confidential information for product approvals. James Andrew Lewis, the senior vice president at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, he wrote last summer that China does not play by the rules and has gotten away with it for far too long. He wrote that the goals of Chinese policy are easily summarized. They wish to extract technology from Western companies, use subsidies and non-tariff barriers non-tariff barriers to competition to build national champions, and then create a protected domestic market for these champions to give them an advantage as they enter out into the world. So businesses, they just know now that they have to give up some of their intellectual property to do business in China. They either pay that price, or if they don't want to do that, well, then they miss out on selling to this market of a billion people. 1/7 of the population of the world just cannot buy their goods. So they're pushed into this impossible position. They've either got to, you know, risk their future as a company by handing over intellectual property, or risk their future as a company by missing out on the Chinese market. And when they pay their price, as so many do, China uses that expertise to build up Chinese firms with that government help, or with government help, with those secrets, and then they often outcompete the American firms that they stole from. Now, this is really well known. I read you a couple of quotes from experts on that. Here's an interview from last summer on Bloomberg TV with Wendy Cutler, vice president at the Asia Society Policy Institute.
To address these issues.
Yeah, I mean, China is trying to move its manufacturing up the value chain, and part of that is forcing the US to hand over intellectual property if a company does business there. But isn't that what always happens? I mean, Samsung stole engineers from Sony. That's just the way the world works, no?
No, this goes way beyond what has happened among other countries and companies. Basically, U.S. companies in China are really between a rock and a hard place. They're told, if you want to do business here, please turn over your intellectual property. And if you don't do so, then we're not interested in partnering with you. So our companies have tough decisions to take. And I think it's time our government, you know, try and address these practices.
So again, this is something that's well known. I mean, all of these things that I'm talking about today, they've really been talking points for Donald Trump while he's been on the campaign trail and other speeches that he's been given a lot. But how much do you hear about this when you see news media talking about the trade war and saying, well, Donald Trump is starting a trade war? You know, they know all of these facts. They've reported on these facts themselves. I could be quoting to you. I don't think I brought them. I've tended to go with experts, but I could have been quoting to you from articles from the New York Times, from many of these other news organizations. There are interviews on all of these TV channels. They know exactly what's happening, but they don't give this background in this context way too often when talking about what's going on with the latest news from Donald Trump and trade tariffs. They just report only very, they report none of this context, and then it just kind of makes it sound like Donald Trump is single-handedly starting a trade war for no good reason. America has been under this massive and sustained trade attack for years. Now, these factors have been huge, but one of the biggest ways that China cheats, we'll get to now. Now, and this is something that may be slightly more complicated than those last two ones that we've talked about. There's a little bit of economics background that's just crucial to understand to get the full depth of the subtle trade war that China was waging. It takes a bit to explain. But this is exactly why China, and this is how Germany cheats. This is how Germany cheats as well. But this is why they get away with their trade attacks. They know that if it's even just slightly complicated, most people won't bother to understand it. They won't put forward the mental effort to understand it. And therefore, if they're not even going to understand it, well, they're not going to put pressure on politicians to do anything about it. But this is something that cries out for fixing, for America to work on. It's, well, one estimate, they estimate that this particular trade attack is costing, just from China, is costing the American economy half a trillion dollars a year. And this is exchange rate manipulation. So the way the current global economic system is designed to work, I think it was 1977, but it's designed to work on a free floating exchange rate system. So the exchange rates, how much you have to pay to get foreign currency, is determined by markets rather than the government. So under this system, the exchange rate for the dollar is determined by how many people want to buy dollars and how many people want to sell dollars and what price people are willing and able to buy and sell these dollars. And this has this is very significant for exports and imports. So the US, it imports a lot more than it exports. It spends much more money buying goods from other countries than other countries spend buying goods from America. Now, to do this, that means America has to buy lots of foreign currency, because if you're buying a lot of German cars, well, you need to pay euros for those German cars. Those German manufacturers that take payment in euros. So you have to buy a lot of euros. Buying lots of euros means giving up lots of dollars in exchange for those euros. So if you're importing a lot, that automatically means you're selling a lot of dollars to buy all those imports. Selling a lot of anything pushes the price down, because there's a lot available, it becomes cheap. So if America imports a lot, there's an automatic response there that makes the dollar weaker. Now, this acts as an automatic solution to that problem. So we'll put some numbers on this to make this a little more understandable. So imagine there's a car that sells in Europe for 10,000 euros. And if we imagine that $1, just to keep things simple, is worth 1 euro, well, that 10,000 euro car would sell in the US for $10,000, ignoring any tariffs or anything like that. But now imagine the dollar gets weaker. Now you have to spend $1.25 to buy 1 euro. Your dollar doesn't spread as far. Well, now that 10,000 euro car, it costs $12,500. It's more expensive. Nothing has changed apart from the fact that the dollar has become weaker. Well, what's the result of the dollar getting weaker? Fewer people are going to be buying these European cars and all other goods from Europe, because they're now, that weaker dollar means that they're all more expensive. Meanwhile, an American car that costs $10,000 In Europe, that used to cost 10,000 euros. Now that the dollar's weaker, that only costs 8,000 euros. The American car is now much cheaper. You know, that's a bargain. Europeans then start buying more American cars, more American goods. And so this system automatically balances itself. America imports more than it exports. That makes the dollar weaker. The direct effect of a weaker dollar is that America starts importing less and it starts exporting more because its exports are much better value. And then this returns it to balance. Its imports go down, exports go up, back to importing roughly the same amount as it exports. That kind of self-correcting mechanism is at the heart of how a free-floating exchange rate system is supposed to work. In theory, and the in theory is big and bold and very important, in theory, the system tends towards a balance where every nation imports about the same as it exports. In practice, it isn't quite so neat. For example, the dollar's status as the world's reserve currency makes the dollar far stronger than it would be otherwise, and that's part of the reason why America, for just so long, does import much more than it exports, and that doesn't get corrected. So there's a few other things as well that do kind of complicate the reality of that theory, but that's the way that things that, well, the theory is the way things are supposed to work. The principle of a free-floating exchange rate, that's what just about every major of the economy in the world has signed up to. That is in the agreements for things like the International Monetary Fund, for the World Trade Organization, for the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs that form the foundations of the modern system of international trade. Everybody signed up to this system. But nations like China don't play by those rules. They've signed up to them, but they ignore them. They don't allow, or at least historically hasn't allowed, its currency to float. They haven't allowed the renminbi, the Chinese currency, the value of that to be determined by market forces. Instead, China keeps its currency, or has kept its currency, artificially weak. And this acts as an invisible subsidy on everything China exports, and an invisible tariff on everything China imports. So, for example, a Chinese smartphone that may have originally cost $250, well, because the renminbi is weaker than it would have been otherwise, your dollars go much further, and so that smartphone made in China now only costs $200. Not because China's any better at manufacturing smartphones fundamentally, but because they've manipulated their currency. So the result is Americans buy lots of Chinese smartphones, American brands relocate their factories and make them in China because it's artificially cheaper to do that. American consumers get cheaper phones, but American manufacturers lose out. And the result is this massive trade imbalance with China exporting a huge amount to the United States and not much going the other way. And then the correction mechanism built into that system that should kick in doesn't. China's currency doesn't move as a result of this imbalance, and so it's never fixed. China just keeps exporting a ton to the United States. And this has been going on for years, and China and the US refuses to confront China on this. Everybody knows this was happening. There's some debate on whether it's still happening, and that may be valid. But at least historically, just about everybody agrees that it has been happening. There was an Omnibus Trade and Competitive Act of 1988 that requires that the US Treasury identifies all currency manipulators or anybody that is, quote, gaining unfair competitive advantage in international trade through manipulating their currency. China was given that label from 1992 to 1994, but they've never been given it since, despite the fact that just about all major economists agree that they have done just that. For example, see Fred Bergston, senior fellow and director emeritus at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He wrote, China was the champion currency manipulator of all time from 2003 to 2014. I mean, even in 2010, even the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, said that they were manipulating their currency. Yet at the same time, the Treasury refused to identify them as a currency manipulator. The Economic Policy Institute, they estimate that Chinese currency that currency manipulation led by China increased the U.S. trade deficit by between $200 and $500 billion a year. So that leaving the American economy due to trade imbalances, going to Chinese manufacturers instead of American ones. That's huge, half a trillion. They estimate that stopping this would increase the size of the American economy by between 2% and 4.9% a year. They estimated that, stopping this would create between 2.3 and 5.8 million jobs. And crucially, 40% of these jobs would be in the manufacturing industry, industries that actually make things that has been missing for so long. Now, I think maybe some of these numbers, and there's a huge range on these numbers, and it is very, very hard to quantify exactly how much this is hurting the United States. And this is where some of the debate among economists come in. I think everybody agrees China has been doing this. The debate is, does it matter? Just because some will argue, well, okay, yes, you've also got to look at the U.S. consumer who would have had to spend $250 on the smartphone. Well, he only spent $200. Now he's $50 richer. What does he do with that extra $50? And maybe he uses that to go to Starbucks and buy a couple of cups of coffee. I know Starbucks isn't quite that expensive. But the point is, he spends that money within the United States, and that money is being spent there. And so some economists will say, well, it doesn't matter so much. The same kind of goes for the argument on subsidies. But what I think that analysis misses is, even if it does balance out, it still shifts the American economy away from manufacturing. And it means that all the manufacturing money ends up going to China, while America is left with this economy that only really works on service industries, industries that fundamentally don't manufacture things. And that, as Donald Trump pointed out, even in the clip that we played at the start, has a huge impact for American national security. If you don't make things yourselves, that puts you at a vulnerability. You know, in time of crisis, and even in times of economic crisis, you want to be a country that makes stuff, not a country full of restaurants and baristas, because that very quickly goes when an economic crisis hits. I guess that's probably a bit more detail than I originally intended to get into, but that's kind of the debate that goes on within economists. That everyone agrees China has been skewing the economic system that way, and that has led to this massive relocation of manufacturing jobs to China. And as I also said, there is still some debate on whether China is still a currency manipulator. Some argue that China has shifted its stance in recent years, ending its manipulation as it tries to replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And that may be true. But the fact that China has done this for years is beyond dispute. And really, if you look at the experts, I think the only argument that makes any sense against what Donald Trump But one of the main ones that people say is, well, it's a bit like shutting the state. It's just too late that China's kind of won the trade war already, and that there's not really any point fighting anymore. They don't need these. They've kind of taken all the tech secrets from America. They've taken the manufacturing industries from America. At this point, fighting a trade war is not going to do anything about that, because they've all gone over to China. I mean, that attitude is pretty defeatist, but it shows how much success they've had already. Well, we've gone quite a while without a break. We'll take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll talk about Germany and their even subtler trade war on the United States.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We've been talking about trade war today. We've been talking about China's trade war on America. But let's move on and look at Germany's trade war on America. Now, Germany's trade policy overall is set by the European Union. And the straight up tariffs, Europe is already more protectionist than America is when it comes to trade between the two. In most areas, the two have about the same tariffs. But in cars and processed foods, the EU puts a fairly heavy tariff on goods coming from the US. But the US doesn't do anything the other way around. So a small advantage to the EU already. But Germany, just like China, the bulk of Germany's trade war comes from currency manipulation. And Germany has done this brilliantly and far more subtly than China. Whether intentionally or not, the euro has manipulated the currency markets greatly in Germany's favor. So just like China's currency manipulation, the euro stops the normal self-correcting mechanisms of the floating exchange rate that we talked about in the first half of the program. It stops that from working. So prior to the introduction of the euro, currencies from southern European countries, they tended to get weaker compared to Germany's Deutschmark over time. And that makes sense. Germany had a strong exporting economy, and so its currency would get stronger. Meanwhile, southern Europe imported a lot from Germany, and that made their currencies weaker. And that went some way to correcting the imbalances. German goods became more expensive, and southern Europe was able to remain relatively competitive as the weaker exchange rates made their exports cheaper. But then the euro came along and ended that. Southern Europe and Germany were now locked in the euro effectively with one exchange rate that can never move. The result is that Germany now exports more and more to southern Europe, and there's no built-in corrections to adjust that. And so Germany's exports to the rest of the eurozone have really increased. But the euro did more than that. Germany, because it's a strong, it's a stable currency, it had the great reputation of the Bundesbank, that meant that a lot of people wanted to put their savings in Deutschmarks because that was seen as a very safe investment. And that made the Deutschmark and combined with all of Germany's exports, that made the Deutschmark a very strong currency. Now, the euro is much more uncertain. There's much less demand for euros because people are less certain about its future. It's got southern European nations part of that currency block, and that weakens it. According to last summer's report from the International Monetary Fund, the euro is about 10 to 20% cheaper than a purely German currency would be. So that means that a German car that in a fair market would cost $10,000 actually now costs somewhere around $8,000 or $9,000 because of this weaker euro, the euro being weaker than a Deutschmark would be. And so no wonder Germany is this exporting powerhouse. They have this built-in advantage. It has the same effect that China's currency manipulation has. And the fact that the euro would be weaker than the Deutschmark and give Germany this advantage, you know, that was clear all the way from the start. All the way back in 1995 in his best-selling book, The Rotten Heart of Europe, Bernard Connolly, you know, he said exactly that would happen. He said that a monetary union cannot survive without a political union, as the Bundesbank has said time without number, but there will not be a political union cohesive enough for everyone to put union interests above national interests. It follows, therefore, that a single European currency will be weaker than the Deutschmark. You know, he forecast that that 1995, that was 4 years before the euro was launched. Now, economists do argue whether the euro advantage is deliberate or whether it's an unforeseen side effect of the system. But the effect is undeniable. Since the euro was introduced in 1999, Germany's trade surplus, the amount that it exports compared to what it imports, has just exploded. It shot up dramatically, reached higher levels than ever before. So Germany is benefiting, and it's waging a much subtler war on the United States through this currency manipulation that comes via the euro. Now, the Bible prophesies a trade alliance that matches very closely with the two powers that are already waging economic war on the United States. Isaiah 20, chapter 23, it talks about a mart of nations, a trading relationship. That chapter is full of references to ships, to oceans, to merchants, to overseas trade. It's talking about a prophesied trade relationship. The book of Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 30, it talks about how this whole book is prophecy for the end time. That trade alliance, it includes Tyre. It was a major economic power at the time that Isaiah wrote, and it's a type of the economic power rising in Europe. It also talks about China using its ancient name of Kitim. There's other nations, such as Japan and Italy, that are mentioned as well. And you can write for our free book, Isaiah's End Time Vision, that gives more proof on who exactly these nations are in the Bible. And you can learn more about this prophesied mart of nations from that book. So it talks about a trading alliance that includes Germany and includes China, these nations that already are waging economic warfare on the United States. And there are other scriptures that talk about a trade war on the United States. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, there God tells Israel that if they disobeyed him, that their enemies would besiege you in all your gates to cut off their economy from the outside world, the most extreme form of a trade war. Ezekiel's chapters 4 and 5 describe a siege of Jerusalem and the other tribes of Israel. And that siege is outlined in Ezekiel 4. That's never happened in all of history. And in fact, the northern tribes of Israel had been carried away into captivity well before Ezekiel even wrote that prophecy. So what's the point of Ezekiel describing this trade? I mean, this siege? Well, it's a prophecy for modern times, for the modern descendants of those tribes of Israel that had been carried into captivity in Ezekiel's times. And that those modern nations, that's America, that's Britain, which you can read about in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. So you put these scriptures together, and it's clear that this mart of nations in Isaiah 23 is in opposition to Britain and America. And eventually they cut America and Britain too off from trade completely and bring those nations down. Mr. Flory wrote about that in Isaiah's End Time Vision. He wrote that with a German-led Europe possessing great maritime power, North America will be surrounded on the east by Europe and the south by Latin America. The Bible contains many prophecies of the European power attacking America and many other prophecies of America being besieged. That is where China and the giants of Asia enter the picture. When the Holy Roman Empire attacks North America, there'll be no help or sympathy from Asia. In fact, considering that China has come to possess most of the world's strategic sea gates, which ironically at one time were held by Britain and America, we believe there will be a brief alliance between the German-led Holy Roman Empire and certain Asian powers, Russia, China, Japan, the kings of the East. Should Europe, the resurrected Holy Roman Empire, find a way to take advantage, even for a moment, of key resources and strategic holdings of China, Russia, and Japan, it would have more than enough power to besiege the Anglo-Saxon nations and enslave them. Now, here's what Mr. Flory said about some of these prophecies in a Key of David program back in December of 2011.
December 1964, Plain Truth. This is what was written. That was under Herbert Armstrong. Deuteronomy 28, 49, 52 says that he shall besiege you in all your gates. That's about a trading blockade. It's about finances. It's about the economy. somebody is going to damage America and Britain financially. And certainly Britain absolutely would starve to death shortly if they didn't get their exports out and their imports in. But here is a blockade, and it's really applying to the U.S. as well. Here we are today with the highest debt this world, any nation or even a continent in this world has known. It's dangerously high, over $15 trillion and rising fast. Can we ever pay that money back? And the answer is no, but we don't know that. We need help from God, and God would help us if we would just trust Him.
So there's this trade war that's brewing. They're going to attack America economically. While the powers mentioned in Isaiah 23, they're already besieging America, albeit in a very small way compared to what's come, what is to come. But their actions show they're no great supporters of America. You know, all that's required for those prophecies to be fulfilled is for Germany and China to band together and to intensify their attack. But they're already besieging America in this small way. Mr. Flurry pointed that out in the Key of David all the way back in 2006.
Every major seagate worldwide once sat under American and British lock and key. Times have changed. Times have changed. Oh, have they ever changed? Do you realize that we are in America in many ways being besieged? And do you know what that means? These are not normal times. Satan has been cast down, and I tell you, you can know what he's doing. And you can see and the impact he's having because he's full of wrath and he knows he just has a short time left. He knows that.
So, in many ways, America is already being besieged. And that's what we've seen and what we've covered today. The way China is attacking the United States economy, has attacked the United States economy, the way Germany is. So what's the solution? Are Donald Trump's tariffs the solution? Are they going to finally fix and solve this trade war? Well, Peter Zeihan, he had a great piece. I think we might have mentioned this before. I know Mr. McDonald mentioned it in a Trumpet brief. He talked about some of the points in favor of what Donald Trump is planning. He also warned, though, that there is the potential for this to these tariffs that target just about all the world could prove catastrophic for the global economy. He wrote, "Do not underestimate how fast this unraveling can happen." He said in the past that he noted that the global system was so fragile and counterintuitive and out of date, it was a waste of time to guess what specific action might cause it to crash apart. An American-initiated trade war is perhaps one of the ways to destroy it most quickly and most thoroughly. He talked about how it could cause a global recession and just all of this trouble in the world. And maybe he's right. I think that's definitely a possibility, and it could cause this mart of nations to come together much quickly. Perhaps confronting Germany and China on these trade attacks, perhaps Mr. Trump will buy the United States some relief for some time from this trade war. Perhaps. But in the long run, this is not going to solve the U.S. economy. And to understand why, you have to understand why the U.S. economy has been so great in the past, why the U.S. was this great producer of things like steel. At one point in the 1950s, the U.S. and Britain produced 3/4 of all the world's steel. Now that figure is around 5%. Why was this? Well, Charles M. Schwab, he was a steel magnate, one of America's top industrialists. He said, "Our United States has been endowed by God with everything to make it and keep it the foremost industrial and commercial nation of the world." Back then, captains of industry recognized that the blessings and the economic prosperity that America had came from God. And the Bible tells us, the Bible prophesied that God would give America, would give Britain those blessings. Deuteronomy chapter 33, it talks about God giving America the precious things of heaven for the dew, for the deep that couches beneath, the chief things of the ancient mountains, the precious things of the lasting hills, and of the precious things of the earth. All of this mineral, metal wealth There are other, you know, Deuteronomy chapter 28, it's full of blessings that you can read in our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, how they apply to the United States. But God, in those same passages, he warns, don't forget where these blessings come from. He warns in the Deuteronomy, you know, when you, he warns lest when you've eaten, when you're full, when you've built goodly houses, when all that you have is multiplied, then your heart be lifted up and you forget the eternally your God. And you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand has gotten me this wealth. God says, don't do that. Know where you got this wealth come from. And if you don't, and if you start disobeying me, I'm going to take that wealth away. And you can read about that in Deuteronomy 28 as well. And that is exactly what has happened. And some of that wealth, a lot of that wealth being taken away, has come through these trade wars. There have been many other curses that are seeing that wealth taken away. But that's at the core of why this is happening. Yes, it's been happening in some ways through China, through Germany. But the core reason is America has disobeyed God. And God is no longer blessing America, God is no longer blessing Britain, and God is now cursing Britain, cursing America. That's why the only lasting solution to America's economic problems is not a trade war on Germany and China. Those trade attacks are part of correction from God, and it's turning to him that's the only sure solution for the nation. But the great thing about this solution is that is a solution. Yes, it could be put in place nationally, but that can be put in place just by you, individually, in your own life, even if the rest of the nation doesn't. You know, you can receive God's blessing in your life regardless of what the nation does. So to learn more about this, the truth of why America is being attacked, to prove the biblical identity for modern America, to learn what you can do, write for our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. You can order that on our website, thetrumpet.com. That's about it from me. Tune in back again tomorrow for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. You can send us any comments at td@kpcg.fm.